Hi, and welcome to Better Off Red. This podcast is a little bit late going up. I'm sure no one notices except me, but I usually try and get these up on a Saturday or a Sunday. But I've just got back from the most wonderful weekend. I spent the weekend up in Waikanae at the Culture, Landscape and Creating Characters workshop put on by Jordan Hart in association with Kahini. It was just fantastic. It was so marvellous. We sat around in the most beautiful surroundings at this fantastic house with the doors open. The weather was unbelievable. We listened to each other's writing. We talked and talked and talked about what landscape might mean and the different ways that landscape is in literature. And it was just marvellous. The other great thing about it is that we sort of used as our, I don't know, I suppose as our platform or as our structure, short stories. We had this wonderful bit where we looked at a lot of examples of extremely short stories. Some were sort of 500 words long, some were only like less than 100, but the power that they pack and this incredible feeling that you feel like you've read an entire novel and you've just read 500 words. So it was a really great structure for the workshop, and Jordan was amazing, and yeah, it was a magnificent weekend. So today, the podcast that comes after this introduction, this episode of Better Off Read, is quite associated with that. On Friday night, Jordan Hart and I met at Mahara Gallery with quite a few other people, and we had a discussion about landscape. We thought that we would talk about what this might mean in writing and use that as sort of a jumping off place in the form of place. You know, we were really talking about place and the places we write from, the places we write to. It was a really interesting discussion, and we had a lot of fun that night as well. There was some food and drink, and yeah, it was a great night. So thank you, Kahini, with big open thank yous. You're amazing. It was just, yeah, it was incredible. And thank you so much, Jordan Hart. There's extreme generosity that you find in teachers and readers and writers. And yeah, we just had a great weekend. So thank you very much. And I hope you enjoy it as much as we enjoyed the weekend. Thank you.
I'd just like to welcome you and thank you for coming along to what is Kahini's first event in Kapiti, and also the first time that we've been able to bring someone from outside of New Zealand to be in this event, which is Jordan Hart, who's come over from the US today, believe it or not, and looks remarkably well considering.
Very
late. We did manage to get him sunburnt though. So Kahini is an international literary arts organisation that does workshops and events that aim to build connections across different kinds of borders, and borders of all kinds of different kinds. And I'm the Oceania coordinator, so at the moment, since about October last year, we've been running events in Wellington, and we've just started running them up here as well. And so Jordan's actually come over to run a writing workshop, which some of you are going to be part of over the weekend, and what we hope is going to become a longer term project. I just also like to say thanks to Mahara Gallery for hosting us, and to ask that you be careful of the objects behind. I'm conscious even as I'm standing here that I've got to keep an eye on them. They're quite fragile and they appear to be flatter than they are. And also to thank Waimea for providing us with some snacks, which you're welcome to help yourself to afterwards as well. So the plan for tonight is that we're going to have a bit of a discussion about reading and writing, which is going to be led by Jordan and Pip. And we really encourage you to engage with us, ask questions, comments, whatever you think. And it builds on, in some respects, a podcast that Pip and Jordan had via Skype or GoToMeeting or one of those technologies, which started talking about one of Virginia Woolf's books and turned into a much wider discussion about literature and teaching and, you know, why we love what we do. So I maybe should just give you a little bit of an overview of the two of them. She probably won't like me doing, but Jordan has been a writer, teacher, and organizer of conferences, and also is the founder of Kahini, so he's really the brains and I think the vision behind this project that we're doing, and has published widely, I want to call it poetry or stories or pieces, but very interesting work that explores, I think, quite complex issues in a really interesting way, and has a book coming out next year, or this year in June, which I'm looking forward to. Pip has published 2 books, and one of short stories and another novel, and teaches at every institution in Wellington, along with having a PhD and a master's from the IML, and is a volunteer at Arohata Prison teaching the woman creative writing, which I think is a really awesome additional thing, gift to be sharing. So with that, I might hand over to Jordan and Pip to lead us on this journey.
Great, thank you.
So thank you again for coming.
Thanks so much, Kirsten. And yeah, thanks everyone for coming. It's awesome. And it's such a beautiful place as well. And place is kind of going to be important for our talk tonight. Jordan and I have been corresponding via Facebook for a while, since we were introduced. And we talked, I'm really grateful for that because it's kind of captured some of our conversations quite literally, which I really, really like. And when we were discussing tonight, Jordan sent this message, which I really love. He said, basically, I'm just thinking it'd be cool to focus around the idea of place as kind of a nice tie-in with the workshop. Place in writing, but maybe also place in how we live our lives, something like that. And it might be cool to do something about place in the process of creation, the process of creating place, and how we do that as writers, whether omniscient or showing place exclusively through the mind of a character or more, thus showing place and revealing and developing character at the same time. Which I think are really nice sort of ideas to sort of kick us off. And especially, I don't know, like being around these objects that appear different in different contexts and being in this place seems really nice, and sort of coming in from outside where it was very warm and sort of coming in here where it's cooler and all those sort of sensory things that come with place and the different ways we experience it. What we really wanted to do with this in mind was to start with a reading. Are you happy to begin with a reading?
Sure.
That'd
yeah.
be awesome. Maybe just so that we can get sort of our writing in the room so that it sort of begins a little bit. So would you like to
sure.
start for us, Jordan?
Just to preface this a little bit, the kind of thing that I do, I'm from Seattle, the Pacific Northwest, in the U.S., and it's got its own sort of culture. It's actually, I think, very similar to here, but has a very close relationship with the mountains, the rain, the ocean, the rain, the mountains, mostly the rain. And this is called Loon. So one of the things about living in Seattle is there are a lot of coffee houses. It's our pastime is drinking coffee, and a lot of performances. And so writers in the Seattle area, like myself, when we write, we're not necessarily thinking about what the words look like on the page. We're really thinking, how are they going to be performed? How are they best going to be delivered to an audience? This is called Loon, and it's about a loon. The loon takes a long time to take off. It needs a lot of water. And sometimes when it gets cold in the winter and the lakes start to freeze up, they don't have enough water to take off, and they freeze because they can't get out of the water. Even if they're not actually surrounded by ice, they're stuck. And I was thinking about this, and this came out. I don't even know what this is. This is called Loon. Head the dark color of a river eddy, body the ruffled white of wind-blown ice, sky slate gray and smoky like motorcycle exhaust. Loon slams the faded door of the watercolored house. Loon sits on the motorcycle in the front yard. Loon revs the engine. Clouds boil above the lake. Loon swims, webbed feet thrashing the water beneath the surface. Loon sits on his motorcycle. The lake is freezing solid and he doesn't have enough water, his wings too slim to lift without a long takeoff. Loon remembers the crunch of pills. Loon remembers swallowing greenies. Loon remembers the feeling as if being swept down a hill, the sun shining on the snow, earth shining. Loon remembers lifting trucks over his head, a sudden god, the chalky taste of the pills. Loon remembers being able to lift off into cold gray air, the color of mountains, and fly. Loon paddles uselessly, cottonwoods glazed with ice, lake glazed with ice, lake whitening all around his slight body, the ice sealing around him. The sun glints off the gray pavement of the road leading away from the water-colored house. Loon leans forward, ignores the pressed faces clouding the window glass. Loon ignores the open red mouths. Loon ignores the howls of each dirty face. Loon remembers looking down on shining white snow, remembers how he could once hear the thoughts of each individual fish or cottonwood. Loon remembers how free he could once feel the clouds coming apart overhead like wet newspaper, and Loon longs to take off. And the dirty faces in the window, they wait in silence, wondering what it is that he will do.
Thanks. That, yeah, it's really odd for a sunny day, because I've also chosen something that... That's part of a chapter of this book, which is about engineers and buildings. But I was really taken by the way in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, that scene where they walk through the wardrobe and the wardrobe becomes the wood. And so I've kind of taken a sort of my swack at it, and it's not as beautiful as that, but what I did here was turn sort of a bushy, what's Hamner Spring, so it's kind of like a bushy sort of scraggy kind of place, and turn it into the Ozarks over there. And I was just thinking it sort of has transformation. That's what I really loved about that piece, is the way that the water transforms. Anyway, I'll just read it. As we walked that day, you told me, sometimes you imagine both of us are dead. And as we walk, I imagine you imagining we are dead. And this is what it looked like then. And to my surprise, this is exactly what it looks like now. The low green bushes straighten and grow into another hemisphere's wood. Our imagined Ozarks. Their branches become ordered and high up. They thin so the sun comes in and sheets, then is gone and it is cold. The noise of our walking feet changes as they land on dusts, then centimetres, then metres of snow that suck our feet back each time we take a step, like sand. We've never seen snow like this. We grow older as we walk through the unseasonal brightness. Years adjust us as we walk. Eventually, we're wearing the dress pants and dress shoes and collared shirts that we left the office in, that we lie in now. We're grown men, structural engineers. You're married to Donna. You have children, but I'm not seeing anyone in particular. People assume I'm with Craig. You do, and Donna does. But it's a front, just like your family home and your kids, just like my indifference to you. So I guess in both those readings, I sort of get this idea of place, infecting character, if you know what I mean, like pushing on character. And I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit, it's a very broad question I'm about to ask you, so you can take it anywhere you want. Can you talk about this relationship between character and place?
In 2009, I was running this writers' conference, and we brought 10 poets, and we had 250 participants. And while the conference was going on, one of the poets found out by going through her boyfriend's cell phone that he had been having an affair.
Oh,
he found, you know, that very specific, you know, that didn't leave anything to the imagination. She had found out that day. And that night, there was a reading that we were doing downtown. It's kind of very similar to here. I mean, it's a very, very beautiful downtown or artistic area. And we were having a reading in a gallery. And he was there. She had brought him with her. He'd been there the whole week. And the woman he was having an affair with was also there. And she had confided to me that she had found out, but she hadn't told him. So there's like maybe 150 people in this room. and maybe five of us, she's told maybe five of us what's been going on. And I'm kind of, that was all I could think about that night. I couldn't think about anything else. And so I would watch him sleeping with two women. He doesn't know that his partner knows about it. So he was actually kind of walking around with his chest puffed out and kind of this peacockish kind of thing. The woman he was having an affair with, kind of insecure in her situation, doesn't know, is he going to leave, you know, this all this stuff. Because I knew her from in a different context. And then this the poet who was totally, felt very, I mean, betrayed, hard, what do I do? This had been the third time that this had happened to her in her life. And so can I ever find anyone? And so I kept thinking, how is each of these people seeing this art gallery, seeing this place differently? On the one hand, for one person, everything is falling apart. For another person, I am this, you know, whatever. I don't even know. And then for this other person, so I really started thinking about place in terms of that way, like the way the modernists would write, James Joyce and Catherine Mansfield and D.H. Lawrence, seeing place through the eyes of a character as opposed to kind of an omniscient narrator. How do different people see the same thing? Mm. Kind of like with your first person narrator, here's how this person sees the bushes, here's how this person sees the trees. That's kind of a roundabout way to talk about this, but I'm really interested in not what does the sun look like, you know, like with Homer setting majestically over the golden sea or anything like that, but I'm really interested in what does the sun look like through the eyes of someone who doesn't know where they're going to sleep that night. Mm. What are they noticing? What are they seeing? Mm. Sort of as place reflecting character as much as us seeing. The other thing I think about is, am I talking too much?
No, I like it when you talk.
So one of our great American novels, and it's greatly problematic because it's so difficult, is Huckleberry Finn. Mm-hmm. I mean, the N-word is used 219 times. It's extremely difficult to read from our perspective now. And yet we see, there's this one scene, I don't remember what chapter it is, like 24 or 25 or something. Huckleberry Finn, this 13-year-old runaway, who is convinced he's going to hell because he admits the humanity of a black person, so he's convinced he's evil because of this. He describes the sun rising over the Mississippi River, over the Illinois side, and he's convinced he's a bad person. And the way he describes it, and it's this two-page sentence, and it is so beautiful, just with, he describes the mist kind of evaporating, and the word whiteness keeps coming up in this really interesting metaphorical way, how the whiteness is disappearing as the sun rises, and there are the forests and everything. And so we get the beautiful writing that sort of pays homage to the incredible world we live in, mm-hmm. but we also see what he's going through at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't trust my society. The only place I'm happy is on this raft. The only place there's firm ground is on this raft. The only place I can trust anything. And here's one thing I can hold on to. I can hold on to this sunrise. Mm-hmm. I know that it's real. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing I think of, I think, thinking about place.
Because I just think this idea of reading place, I kind of wanted to touch on as well. You know, like as a new, I'm going to say this all wrong, but I really haven't been a lot of places. Like I haven't lived overseas. I've traveled a little. I've been lucky enough to travel a little bit later on. But a lot of the places that I want to write about, I've only ever read about. And you went to Catherine Mansfield's house today. Is that right? It was today,
yeah,
wasn't it? Yeah,
her birthplace.
So happy. Yeah. And I just I get, what do I want to say about that? I guess what I'm interested in is the way we build an imaginary Mississippi, mm-hmm. or the way we build an imaginary Days Bay, mm-hmm. or the way we build you know, an imaginary Dublin. And I'm wondering, I don't even know, could you talk about that? Does that spring anything to mind?
It's really interesting because, I mean, the great thing about reading, we're all readers, I mean, the great thing about reading is
someone will go, I hate reading.
Well, no, like sometimes I start talking about reading and people are just like, what the hell? What?
I think this is a safe,
like eyes glaze over.
Yeah, yeah.
But we can go places like that we could never travel to. And even if we could travel, none of us could go back to 1810 Russia. Mm. We could not do that, even if we had a lot of money to fly. Mm. You know, we couldn't do it. But when we read like War and Peace, all of a sudden we're in this world where, so Napoleon is invading Russia. And yet at the same time, everybody looked at French as the language everybody wanted to be speaking. Mm-hmm. And it was the language of the court because it was considered higher than English, higher than Russian. If you could speak French, you were considered to be cultured while the French Empire is invading you. And so I think that's really ridiculous. But then I look around sort of even at the United States, you know, it's like I think a lot of, you know, our movies and our TV shows are everywhere, and there's it's not the same, but it's still kind of a subvert. It's this horrible octopus that is kind of like. But our music is good.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's good. But so I'm able to read a novel like that of a place I can never go to in a world I could never be in, and then understand more about my own world.
Yeah.
I think a little bit. What is it like to feel that sense of invasion, even though French is being held up as some kind of a cultural construct, is really interesting to me.
Because I think I said that to you in a later message was I've just finished reading a book. It was new to me. A writer called Jose Saramago, and it's a book called The Gospel According to Jesus Christ, and it's a rewriting of the Christ narrative, but it talks about the Middle East and the way, I think I said this to you in the email, the way that it talks about the place of the Middle East, yeah. Like what the landscape looks like, yeah. And what it's like to walk there and move there, really explained a lot of the hard stuff that's going on in the Middle East at the moment. There was something about place more than character. And I don't know, like, I think I've been someone that's always valued character above place or character above description.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think what I really love about your writing and about, you know, when you talk is that idea of integrating the two together, mm-hmm. which I think really... it really excites me, and I think I'm really interested because what I love is every biography I've read of yours, it always says I'm a writer, a teacher, and a reader, and I wanted to just maybe chip away or sort of tease out that idea of being a reader. You know, like what is the relationship between reading and writing?
Well, I feel like reading does so much more than like television ever could, because mm-hmm. when we watch. We can see what things look like and sound like, but that's really all we can do. But when we read, not only are we doing that, but we're smelling whatever the character is smelling. We're feeling on our skin, mm. in our bodies, whatever the character is feeling in that moment, and we're tasting whatever the character is tasting. So it's literally, we can inhabit a skin that is not, like when we read Things Fall Apart,
mm.
all of a sudden we are Igbo people, mm. being colonized, and we can feel what that is like in a way that would have been impossible without that. And we make different decisions after, I mean, once you've read Things Fall Apart, once you've read, you know, the Satanic Verses, once you've read The House of the Spirits, mm-hmm. I don't feel like we can make decisions the way that we did before, mm-hmm. because now we know what it's like to be another human.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know what it's like to be like in their shoes, exactly, and we have empathy, we have mutual understanding with somebody else that we didn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
But as writers, I feel like it's our job to communicate what it's like to be us. And even if it's not us, even if it's fiction, and we're creating a fictional character, we're still creating the emotional truth of what it's like to be that fictional mm-hmm. character in that world. So that we're communicating our perspective, I think, and our point of view
mm.
to our readers.
Mm. So talking a little bit, like just to tease that out a little bit, I really like, when I spoke to you for the podcast, I really enjoyed when we touched on that idea of the writer's life, like what that may look like, and, you know, the places that we live. And I really enjoyed your discussion about what Seattle, you know, what the Seattle writing scene was like. And I was just thinking a little bit about those places we inhabit kind of, yeah, what am I trying to say? I heard this term the other day. There's a great interview, Mark Maron interviewed Richard Linklater maybe last week or the week before on his WTF podcast, and he was talking about this idea of a life artist. Like Richard Linklater was talking about this German word, this idea that we live the art as well as mm-hmm. sitting down at the, you know, like this is art time and this is the other time. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what, if someone said to you, writer's life, you know, what is your writer's life like? Like, what does your life look like because you are a writer and a teacher and a reader?
Well, I think there's a Seattle-based writer named Rebecca Brown, and I had a conversation with her maybe 15 years ago, and she said when she sits down to write, and she's written, you know, 8 novels and 20 million nonfiction books and a lot. I mean, she's done all this stuff, but when she sits down to write, she says she never knows where she's going. And she won't write unless she hears a phrase. So one time she said she heard the phrase, "I did not kill the child in the garden." I had no idea what it meant. And it's a little macabre. It's a little dark. No, it's not appropriate for a day like today. But that's what it's Seattle, whatever. So the phrase was, "I did not kill the child in the garden." She didn't know what to do with that. So she wrote it. And then she just followed that and then kept going and kept going. She said, and this has always stuck with me, she said that when she sits down with an agenda, when she sits down with, here's the story I want to tell, or here's the point I want to make, she says that it's dead on arrival, because, for her, and I found it's true for me, because she's imposing her will on characters who may have their own agenda, their own will. So what she tries to do is sit down and follow either the language through the sound, or follow a character. So for me, I was in Mexican Hat, Utah, which is really close to Bluff.
Yep.
And it was after, it was in the middle of summer, so they're having thunderstorms. So there was this vicious thunderstorm, beautiful, but vicious thunderstorm all afternoon, and then it went away. And the clouds were parting, and it was sunset. And I was down by this river, and it was muddy and swollen and rushing really fast. And there were two guys who were being really suspicious, and they had a car parked behind a bush. And when they saw me, they started getting even more suspicious, and they had a three-legged dog with them, and they were smoking, and they saw me, and they went and they hid behind another bush. I mean, I'm just a little old me, I'm not, whatever. So I stared at them for longer than was probably safe, and then I left and went back to the place we were staying, and I couldn't shake the image of two guys. One of them was older, one of them was probably 16, 17. And so I kept, who are they? What are they doing? What are they doing? And then the thunderstorm had started, lightning was crashing again. So I sat out, and the rain's pouring, and I'm writing. So I started there. Two men and a three-legged dog and a rusted Suburban hidden behind a tamarisk tree. And then I just tried to figure out. But the story started going backwards. So it wasn't going forward. It was, how did they get to that point? So it was like earlier. And the next thing I know, I had 4 pages, which to me is an eternity of writing. And I had figured out who they were and what they were doing fictionally. So I was able to try to step into someone else's shoes, you know, and attempt to inhabit that. And I wasn't looking at Utah the way I would see it. I was trying to look at it the way they would see it and inhabit them. And ultimately the story, over 45 drafts, it became about sort of the American West and the blood-colored dirt of Utah and sort of the kind of the history sort of through them, but I didn't plan any of that. It just happened. And if I'd planned all that stuff, it would have felt like propaganda, it would have felt like a polemic, and, you know, here's Jordan's opinion on American history and all this stuff. And so it became it, as opposed to being forced to be that.
Because that's what I find, I always find that really interesting, because I feel, I often feel a real political agenda. Like I often feel, I think there's, I'm not totally impressed with the way things are in New Zealand at the moment. And I often feel myself wanting to talk about that. And I think you're right. I think that what happens is, because I'm talking about it with my friends and because I'm living a life in a community and going places where I'm, you know, for me, I like to go places where I'm not comfortable. And, you know, because I am sort of living, I find this really weird thing where I will start with an image, but it will the politics are kind of just seated in me. That means that it comes out in a way that doesn't feel as polemic I'm starting to go towards polemic at the moment. I'm starting to feel that. Yeah, I'm ready to sit. But I think it's really interesting because I think you're right. I think that idea of being led, it is really interesting because for me, I do think that community is important. Yeah. I do want to be around other people and I want to be, you know, I find that that's important. I did used to dream of being stuck away by myself in a garret, you know, having food slipped under the door, you know, like, you know, go away, you know, and but I think now
very Jane Austen.
Yeah, yes. I want to be Jane Austen. But yeah, but what I've found now is that I do want to be out in the world, and yeah, it's a change. I don't know if it's as I'm getting older or what, but and I feel like my writing is better for it. You know, it's a lot better for it. One of the things that I really like about Kahini is that we don't limit it to just like kind of, oh God, I'm making it sound like a religion now. Kahini, what you'll find is philosophy.
It's more of a timeshare, actually. Like there's some brochures on
that. Yeah, we'd like to talk to you about, but one of the great things is all the events I've been involved with here is that it doesn't, we're really interested in anything that you guys would like to say. We're really interested in conversation. So I'm just wondering if there's anything that anyone wants to make a comment about or has got a question about or wants to talk about their own writing?
I had a question. You say that it's better for a writer to be led by the character and the settings and the story instead of having a preconceived idea in mind, because then it comes out as dead on arrival, as you said. But then there are some writers who actually prefer to have a framework, an outline of a story, and then work within those within that framework and create something within that framework. I don't know whether the result is dead on arrival there, or I don't know which pathway is a better one to take, or whether it's just very individual. It just depends on.
I think it, I mean, correct me, but I think every individual is different. I think every individual is different. So the Scottish novelist Margot Livesey, she describes writing as seeing a faraway hill and knowing she wants to go there, but having no idea how she's going to get there. And some novelists plot it out very meticulously. I've never been able to read their novels, but they do plot it out. Andre Debius, who's an American short story writer, he used to plot out his novels. Then he was writing a story. He wanted to write a story about a highway robbery, where a young couple goes to a drugstore and they steal $150 and they buy beer and white bread and cheese and eat it. That was what he wanted. He did all the research, so he talked to drugstore owners, how much money could someone actually steal, what are the security precautions. He interviewed a lot of people, so he did all this background research, so he had pages and pages of research. And as he was writing, he got stuck. So he was a couple of paragraphs into it and he couldn't go any farther. And he was trying to figure out, why can't I go farther? And at the time, the main character was at a party, at a cocktail party. And so he decided he was not going to continue writing any further until he knew what a glass of wine in his character's hand felt like to the character. He said to himself, I'm not going to write until I am her, and I know what it's like to be her holding this wine. You know, and originally he'd wanted to write this drugstore robbery story, and it would be a story of betrayal, where she would betray her boyfriend and turn him into the police and all this. As he's writing it this new way, he realized she truly loves him. While he's inhabiting her, he realizes, no, she actually loves him. And the story went an entirely different way. There was no robbery. They didn't rob the store. They went to Walmart. They bought groceries. They walked up and down the aisles. They looked at all the things they couldn't afford. And he didn't plan that. He noticed it. He noticed that they didn't buy groceries. He noticed that they bought, I think it was fabric softener or something like that. And then he followed them all the way back home. And then he put the final period to end the story. Nothing exciting happened. There was no robbery. There were no guns. There were no car chases. But when you read the story, I can't remember the title. I'll find out. But when you read it, you're so involved because you're with these people and they're barely making it. They're right on the poverty line. He never says poverty line. Mm. He doesn't bring that layer of abstraction to it. But you feel what it's like to have to walk on the highway 6 miles because you don't have a car, and you feel what it's like. It is so moving.
But are you involved with the characters because you're expecting something to happen, or just because of the way the characters are?
That's a really great question. Because, so when we think of some, like, what do you mean something happening?
As in, you said you really get involved with the characters,
mm-hmm.
right? So you see these characters moving through the departmental store and picking up stuff like fabric softener, which they can't afford.
Yeah.
So, and they're just there at the poverty line. So you're wondering, what's going to happen? Is something going to happen?
Exactly.
Why are they moving?
Yeah.
Why are they buying
yeah.
the fabric softener,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
So is that why you get involved with the character, or do you just get involved with the character in a very literary sense where it's just because of who they are and you just become one of them? And so that's my question.
Yes. Yeah, both. Yeah, both. Because, when you're inside someone like that, the little things become bigger. They become magnified. Thinking about even, Araby by James Joyce,
mm-hmm.
the only thing that happens is that nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to try to buy something and he can't because it's closed.
Mm-hmm.
It's 3 pages. Mm-hmm. But at the end, you feel how depressed he is. And like his whole world is, and it's the dumbest thing,
mm-hmm.
when you're looking at it from the outside.
It's really interesting because someone once told me that brains are ordering machines, like they want to build pattern. And that story, like if you think of the most conventional story
yeah.
arc, which is kind of like how things are, what changes them forever and how they are now, that's kind of like an order that we've got maybe built in. And in this interview, sorry to go back to Richard Linklater again, but he was talking about Boyhood and how there are a couple of scenes in that where not much happens, but there's a gasp from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the father says to the son, be careful driving, don't check your phone while you're driving. And then there's a shot of him on the motorway checking his
mm-hmm.
phone. And everyone's like, oh! And it's really interesting, this idea that you can use something dreadful happening that never happens to kind of pull a story along.
My question is, does that leave the reader feeling dissatisfied at the end? The story, or
I think it might. I think some
yeah.
reader. I mean, absolutely, some readers. If there's not a space alien in it, not interested.
But it sounds like me.
Or if there's not, if there's not a shootout at the end, it's like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
So I think the taste of the reader is going to have a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this idea of satisfaction is such an interesting one. I'm always really interested at the end of a book to think, what was satisfying about that? This is what I found with the Saramago, is that I got to the end and I was like, well, I knew what was going to happen. I knew that it was not going to turn out good for Jesus
yeah.
in the end, although it does, obviously it does kind of turn out good for him. But, I just couldn't work out how he was subverting
yeah.
it, but I felt so satisfied by the end of it. And it is, I think sometimes there's just a magic, it's kind of like a music. Rather than a, story satisfaction,
yeah.
there's a music to it, or there's a, a tonal shift.
I think as a
shift.
Reader, you just have to let go of your preconceived ideas that something's going to happen, or it's going to end this way, and just go with it as it happens.
Maybe. Well, it's kind of two different things that we're talking about, because one is the reader's expectation,
yeah.
and then one is the writer's art.
Okay.
And for me, the writer's responsibility is to write the sentence that when it's written, your body feels like it's a tuning fork and it's being struck at just the right pitch, and it is what it is, and it can't be changed.
Mm-hmm.
That means that maybe 3 people will read it, it means that maybe 400 people will read it. But if we're writing, I want to please the reader, then we're creating, Hollywood movies
right.
where they're making sure that each demographic is being spoken to in
okay.
their own.
Yeah.
But some people write that way. Some people write that way. So.
I had an idea that I wanted to try something out, but I don't know if it'll work. I was just wondering if people would be willing to shout out, like the place in literature that they feel that they've visited the most completely.
Oh, nice.
You know what I mean? Like, I just wonder, like, for me, I probably always think of Bolaño and think of, that imaginary place, which is actually a real place. So, that's the place that I think of. What about other people? Are there places in literature that you can call to mind, that you enjoyed visiting?
Oh my goodness, unfortunately for me, it's Alice in Wonderland.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. It's
for
a
me,
very...
it's Arrakis and Dune from Dune.
Yep.
Yep, yeah,
the
yeah.
The worms are the spice.
In fact, places where
it requires my imagination because it's not a real place.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. That would probably get me more thinking, more. That would probably stay with me longer.
Yeah.
I think historical fiction has got that way because I think a lot about place too. I started a novel a few years back which is set in Kurra Bay, and I then realised that when you write about, when you're doing historical fiction, you've got to get time frames right. So I was writing set in the war. I realised that I set it in a bunker during the war, but the bunker would have been inhabited by soldiers. And so, you know, in those Cook Road Bay, there's a bunker.
Oh,
yeah. I realised I'd stuff that up, so that stopped that book. I should come back to me because I don't remember my point, so that's
not. It is that interesting idea, right? Like this idea of imagined and real. Do people, when someone says, it's Pukehoe Bay, 1945. Because that's the other thing I think is really interesting. I think that's the wrong year for the war. Sorry, I've got really bad history badness. I always imagine that that's a new version of that, kind of like an Egan state. You know, like I always think that maybe, this year there are like three movies coming out about Hollywood, you know, but I think Cronenberg's Hollywood is quite different to, Mr. Red Lion's Hollywood. And I just feel like when someone writes, even with historical fiction, even like people that have existed, I feel like the place that they're writing becomes this strange, as science fiction, you know, as strange in science fiction as Alice in Wonderland or Dune, the place where Dune is. Yeah, I don't know.
Totally. Like the 80s, you know, and movies as well. Like the 80s version of the 1950s.
Right.
Version of the 1960s, you know. Yeah.
Historical fiction is just as speculative as science fiction.
Yes.
We can't know, especially if we go back further than 50 years.
Yeah, I think that was my point, is that it's useful to go back further than any current living reader.
Yeah.
That's that really brilliant. My parents' generation grew up during that time, and New Zealand's full of people. Telephone cord, like it'll be that detailed because it's just their childhood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a real challenge to write place if anyone is alive who remembers it.
Mm.
And another thought about place was I've just returned here after about 18 years abroad, and I am currently finding New Zealand incredibly small, and that worries me. And I know that it will expand as I kind of get more grounded, but. That sense that what's small to me is safe and secure to other people, and if you've been here a while, then you can be in New Zealand and look out, whereas I've been out and now I'm looking in, and I'm like, oh, you know. And in terms of literature, we were talking in the car coming up here about this, what I think is quite a weird dichotomy or irony, where people overseas think New Zealand is all about place, that it's just so beautiful, and that's all they ever say, it's so beautiful, it's so lovely, it's so green, it's where we're going when climate change destroys the world. But they're not actually interested particularly in reading New Zealand literature. They're not really interested in our culture and our stories because it's too small. And our relationship with place is sort of only interesting if it's historical fiction, in which case we can all imagine, including the writer, and certainly the reader can imagine. Or, the whole man alone, sort of stark, isolated, New Zealand's kind of weird, the big mountains, the small person. But our everyday relationship to place that we actually have here, I think there's much of an international audience for it. And I think it's very challenging for us as writers to tell stories that are interesting to the rest of the world, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe don't involve murder or crime fiction.
Can we kill some people?
And I wonder how much of it is self-imposed as well, because it's like I know when a writer from the US came over and it was like she was here teaching for about 3 months, and any time anyone asked her, oh, how are you finding it? As soon as she didn't say, oh, it's so beautiful,
so
and the people are really friendly, their eyes glazed over. They were completely uninterested in knowing that she was going to say anything other than it's so beautiful and the people are really friendly.
As an outsider, if I said that there's this really old woman who was mean to me,
This is something, talking about place and beauty, like I remember being with a friend who was from New York, and people were saying to her, oh, you must love the nature here. And last year we went to Yosemite Park and I was just like, fuck. You know, like this was, I understood place in a way that I have never understood it before. And the other thing that I thought was interesting was I understood being in place where you can't be alone, this idea of man alone, because everywhere we went there were a lot of people. And I saw a man sitting in reverence looking at this huge rock form, and there was a waterfall, and I just thought, wow, this is an interesting idea that we enjoy, because I think that's something we do get drummed in here, is that we enjoy nature in isolation. But I really love this idea, because honestly there were all these people sitting around, there were people doing yoga, there were people sitting in meditative poses looking, and there was a man, I just remember him kind of looking in reverence, and I think it's really interesting, because that feels like a similar kind of thing with a book, where, you know, like if you've ever been in a book group, like everyone reads the book, but everyone's like, oh, I saw this part of it, and I saw this part of it, and I just think it's really gorgeous. I don't know.
That story about a woman being mean, that's extremely interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, that, the average, I mean, a person, we care more about, if we prick our pinky, we care more about that than 50,000 people dying that we've not met. It's just who we are as people. And so if we can inhabit you going through that situation, or a fictional construct, you went through a fictional, but it, where it's emotionally truthful, I mean, it's going to hit us just as hard as, you know, an earthquake swallowing up the moon. I don't know.
So basically people don't really care much about complacence and happiness and peace. They want things happening. They want action. They want something happening which is out of the ordinary. And for New Zealand, the ordinary would be mountains and trees and beauty and so wonderful people.
Sorry. Just an impression.
Frisco's pretty big here. Frisco's is pretty big here.
I think story is fueled by something unsettled.
Yeah.
You know, if two people are wonderfully happy, that's great, and it's great to be that person. I don't know that that's necessarily, but if there's even a sense of something unsettled,
even something under the surface, which doesn't really show outright, but it's there.
That's enough of a to get started, and then we see where we go.
Yeah.
I mean, 90% of what we start, I'm just making this blanket statement, we probably don't finish because it doesn't go where we want it to go. Yeah, you know, we start, but that's the process.
It's a Heather old part of it, isn't it? You can have all the characters and narrative and plot in your rhythm, but if you are not a disciplined writer, if you cannot find a rhythm for yourself, whatever that rhythm is, then it's not going to get finished.
Well, maybe Costco's is in sale.
Yeah, the construction of the toasters in this country is very exciting, so it's hard to, you know.
Yeah, I personally tend to blame the story and not the writer. Yeah.
You're mixing with.
The other thing, oh, sorry, Mark. Yeah.
I've just arrived.
To flip that on its head, I read something about turning character or landscape on its head. The settlement around the Maunganui River in the Maori identify as a lot of landscape, and they talk about Koaute, Kotawa. I am the river, the river is me.
Yeah.
And in that settlement, they have said that the river is an identity, that it has like a corporation, you know, we have a construct. So the idea that the landscape has become a character. And that's like an unsettled, it's like, that immediately sort of go, whoa, and therefore what does that do to my world or the way I see it? And so there are some spaces beyond Briscoes and Toasters, you know, where there's some ways of seeing the world that are distinctive. And I think that's kind of one that our landscape, Maori and the people who live here and the Pākehā Europeans, there's something about those interactions that is an interesting story.
Because that was one of the greatest things. That was one of the things that kept me thinking after we talked last time was... we were talking about a story of yours, a piece of yours. I can't remember the name of it now, of course. But what I really liked is that you were talking about, I'm probably going to misquote you, so please correct me, the idea that often your interest is with the landscape rather than the people inhabiting the landscape. You know, like, and I think that that's what, and I was just reading Three Men again today, and this idea that,
that's not a pornographic story.
Isn't it? I was reading it wrong. No, but...
I got up one time to read this piece called Three Men, and this guy in the back goes, yes! And I was like, oh, this is going to be a letdown.
You're going
to
be a letdown. But can you maybe clarify that point again that you were making then? You know, like just that idea that landscape as, you know, is it landscape as character that you're talking, you know, like you said this beautiful thing and I can't remember what it was. Can you remember what it was?
Well, I think, Mark, your point is well taken. I mean, I think a lot of times, I sat in a workshop one time and the instructor said, I don't care about the moon, I care about the person looking at the moon. And I thought, I care about the moon. I don't care about the person looking at the moon. And I think we are so saturated, without realizing it, the landscapes that we inhabit, whether they're urban or rural, or they I mean, the moon affects the tides.
Yeah.
Imagine what it does to sap in a tree, and imagine what it does to our bloods, if it's moving oceans. And I think sometimes we forget how part of nature, how part of landscape we actually are.
Mm.
And so when I'm reading a story and that awareness is shown, when I'm seeing how the landscape is affecting the character, but also how the character is maybe shaping their human landscape, how they're responding to it, that's where personally as a reader I find a lot more interest.
Mm.
As opposed to, because if someone doesn't even admit how powerful nature is on them, I'm not going to trust their piece. It's like we were talking about the historical details.
Mm-hmm.
If we're reading a historical piece and a couple of details are wrong,
mm-hmm.
we start to lose faith in the writer a little bit. And it's the same thing if we're reading something where it's so, I can never pronounce anthropomorphic correctly, but it's so human-centered.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to trust that writer because there's so much they're leaving out, but that's a personal aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of readers are fine with that.
Yeah.
But personally, I will just put it down.
Yeah. I keep thinking of Solaris every time you talk about, you know, just this idea that there's something so beyond us that we don't understand it, and how does one sort of explain that? And I often feel that way with nature, and I think, yeah, I just think, oh, I don't know, yeah, I totally, I'm with you there.
Yeah.
I just think, yeah, I think it's really important. You've been a lot of different places. You're wearing a bear that says Rwanda. Do you think that some of the things that we're talking here are culturally bound to us? Or do you think, like this idea of, you know, like perhaps conflict pushing a story, or I'm just really interested if
yeah. Well, it's tough because, I mean, Emily Dickinson never left a very narrow, you know, and she wrote incredible pieces exploring the human, you know, Jane Austen only traveled within a, you know, so I think that, no, I don't think it matters. I think,
mm-hmm.
you know.
I think it's about richness. Where do you find that richness?
Yeah.
Indian literature has such a richness of character because it's such a complex social environment and, you know, it's thousands of years old, caste system, et cetera, and ethnic differences. And nature-wise, it's so wonderfully rich as well.
Mm.
So the best Indian writing combines those. And I guess that was kind of my point. I feel challenged trying to find the richness here. I'm not saying it's not possible. It's just that I've got to think about it in a new way, having lived in some of those kinds of countries and cultures.
It's probably just about the shift of perspective. You just have to look for it.
Which is the whole interesting part of being a writer.
And there's that wonderful thing where often the most wonderful stuff has been written home to, if you know what I mean. Like, you know, like when you think about Catherine Mansfield writing overseas about Days Bay or something, you know, often that's an interest. And, you know, I always think of Moby Dick, how a lot of that was written at home, not near the sea. You know, I think it's often interesting what happens when we separate ourselves from the place and then try to write back to it as well. I think that's really interesting too. Do you have something else you want to read for us?
Oh,
that might be a nice way to finish.
Yeah, this,
would you be willing to do that?
This is by Terry Tempest Williams. It's very short. It's called An Unspoken Hunger. It's about a paragraph long. It is an unspoken hunger we deflect with knives. One avocado between us, cut neatly in half, twisted then separated from the large wooden pit. With the green fleshy boats in hand, we slice vertical strips from one end to the other. Vegetable planks. We smother the avocado with salsa, hot chilies at noon in the desert. We look at one another and smile, eating avocados with sharp silver blades, risking the blood of our tongues repeatedly. And that's it. That's the entire story. But it's like, because you can feel the desert and it's the heat of the salsa, but you also get this sense of something unsettled between... I don't really know what it is,
but you know it's there.
Yeah, and then I'm just going to read one more thing really quickly.
Yeah,
this is Margaret Atwood. This is about a paragraph too. She says, whenever I'm asked to talk about what constitutes a good story or what makes one well-written story better than another, I begin to feel very uncomfortable. Once you start making lists or devising rules for stories or for any other kind of abstract or for any other kind of writing, some writer will be sure to happen along and casually break every abstract rule you or anyone else has ever thought up and take your breath away in the process. The word should is a dangerous one to use when speaking of writing. It's a kind of challenge to the deviousness and audacity and perversity of the creative spirit. Sooner or later, anyone who's been too free with it will be liable to end up wearing it like a dunce's cap. We don't judge good stories by the application to them of some set of external measurements, as we judge giant pumpkins at the fall fair. We judge them by the way they strike us, and that will depend on a great many subjective imponderables, which we lump together under the general heading of taste.
She's so good.
That makes me feel good. Because I struggled a long time with this thing of him not liking it but her liking it, or somebody liking certain aspects of my stories but somebody else not.
Mm.
I'm like, what must I do to craft the perfect story, you know? What
thank you.
What you have to do is do surveys and then you bring them all in.
Yeah.
Because art is, every reader will have a different interpretation.
Exactly.
It's like a poem. If someone reads your poem and then they're asked what's it about,
yeah,
they're probably going to say something completely different to what
yeah.
you think it's about, but for them it's very meaningful.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what is happening in Seattle with the writing stuff? Like, you were talking about coffee houses and I just called them coffee
sure,
houses.
Sure.
That sounds like a little bit beat poet. It's not really. Are they?
No, I think it's a lot of wannabe.
Oh, okay, good. Oh, I'm glad. I used the right word then.
No, it's just really interesting. I feel like there's right now, where I'm from, a progression toward more off the page. So I think more spoken
yeah.
word and performance based. I mean, it's been really kind of fun to be a part of. But that's the only
yeah.
thing that
because I think that was something I got carried away with when we were talking about place, was the idea of, God, I'm such a wanker, but the idea of like the white page as a place, you know,
oh,
like a place that we yeah. kind of enter into. And I loved talking to you when you were talking about, if you look at Jordan's work, and I highly recommend you to, it doesn't look conventional on the page. And that's where place again is interesting. Like it, it's this wonderful thing where you do feel very led by the way that it looks on the page, which I think ties into that idea. Because you said
yeah.
that, didn't you? Like, you write it as you would speak it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's
well,
the
for me, I never. Yeah.
Out.
So for me, you know, being the egocentric maniac that I am, it's more when I put it on the page, it's designed to tell me when to pause and when to stop.
Mm-hmm.
So. Wait for laughter here, you know, wait for people to cry here, which they always do it in the opposite of what I want to do. So then when I'm done with it, I have a hard time putting it into a regular
yeah.
punctuation and things, because it's really for me to deliver,
yeah.
you know.
I get really excited about this idea because I mean, I'm so sick of hearing about how publishing's dead and, you know, and I just love this idea that there are these completely, ephemeral acts happening where a work is existing
mm-hmm.
in tone for the time that it's taking to
yeah.
read it. You know, I just love this idea of publishing, like this idea of broadcasting and then it disappears and we all take away the memory of what we heard, not, you know, we don't take it away in an artifact, you know. And I love the idea with your stuff that the act of the reading and the intoning of it comes first, and then the idea
yeah,
of
yeah.
sort of like a butterfly kind of thing, we have to, you know, get it on the page. And and I think that's, I mean, we were talking a bit about that, about, you know, the shape of books. Do you know when your book comes out this year, have you seen the design of it?
Not
all?
Yet, and I'm kind of nervous about
yeah,
it, just because
yeah.
I think it's going to be all... But I've already bought the whiskey to deal with that. So
yeah, yeah, I think
fine.
This is important.
I think it'll be fine. I mean, whatever they want. I'm just excited somebody's actually going to.
Yeah.
So I'll do whatever they want.
I really like That was my favourite thing about the Publishing Act, was that it became a communal activity. You know what I mean? Like it was like, it had always been mine, you know, and then it was great to kind of give it.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, I think we should do this. And I'm like, oh, okay, let's give it a bash. You know, like I just really enjoyed that part. It's really good. Is there anything anyone wants that we're getting near the end? Like we can go and have a drink and hang out. Yes.
Yeah, I just want to comment on the conversation about place. And I was thinking, I've only read the three things I could find on the internet. And you create a really interesting sense of place. But it's sort of vaguely North American, but it's not place in the sense of location. Understand what I mean? Whereas if I read Tim Winton, I'm always in Western Australia. I can't be anywhere else except for the novel that he wrote in Ireland and France. You know, and some other writers are very much like that. I mean, the Alexandra Quartet is in not anywhere else. Yeah? And so it seems to me you've got a slightly different sense of place than that, like the one Lee. There's bits in that that I think, oh yeah, North America. But it's about place in
LSO
sense.
Yeah, that one's hard because the half of that story takes place in the mind of a salmon who's underwater. So it's really interesting to try to, like, what would water feel like if coming through gills? Like, what does that even mean?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to have to swim 900 miles upstream and you're fighting the water the whole time? There's never a moment as a salmon where you can actually take a break as you're fighting it. I think sometimes it's like, and for me it does come back to the character. What does this character feel, you know, in terms of this place right now?
Mm.
And how are they experiencing? I still don't know, like, what does water feel like to a fish?
Mm.
Like, what does air feel like to us? Is it the same? Is it different? Do they know they're in? Because I have this, the salmon jumps out of the water, and so she's in the air. And then comes back to, and that took months of just like, what does that, you know? I actually went into the ocean, splashed around, then tried to jump out and felt like a total idiot, and was no closer to understanding, you know, what that would feel like on salmon skin.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I'm really fascinated about with writing, is trying to know, like trying to understand, what does it mean to be, you know, a 14-year-old girl living on the street? What does it mean to be a 65-year-old man cutting your flowers in your front yard because you want to make sure that the neighbor across the street thinks that you are taking care of you? You know, what does that mean to be inside that consciousness? And so, you know, what do the flowers mean to him? What does the water mean to a fish? That's what I'm really interested in.
Is this like the greatest fucking job in the
world?
Love
it.
Like, I mean, I just totally, I'm just with you. Like, this is,
yeah.
I, you know, people often ask me what I do. And like, when I get an hour to write, I sit there and I go space traveling, you know what I mean? Like, I'm like, yeah, what is it to be, you know, what is it to be that? And what is it to be this? It's just, and I think, I don't know, I used to have very pragmatic ways of explaining process. It was like, oh, well, blah, 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 blah. But I just have this weird thing now where more and more I'm saying, well, there's a sound and it's a sound in my body. That thing you were talking about with the tuning fork.
Yeah.
And when I write it, it sounds right. And then it doesn't sound right. And yeah, and this idea of imagining, this idea of play is so, I don't know, I get really excited about it. That relaxing and play and imagination is so good. And this idea of versions of places, I always find that exciting. Like, just the idea that there's a salmon's version of that lake, but there's also, you know, like, I don't know, I love it. Does anyone have anything else they want to? Oh, yes. Oh, sorry.
This conversation, because in visual arts, it's very similar. It's sort of playing into, you work with some materials, and the material takes over this, what you end up with. And the other, I just want to say this, other similar conversations in other areas, like architecture, is the architecture of place, is the architecture of space. And they've got a very different feel to them.
Yeah.
Right, they're looking for a sort of starless against substance.
Totally.
It's interesting, very similar dialogues
happening.
Lots of
different
artists
depending. Yeah.
So true.
That's
a perfect segue to my question.
Oh, yay! You guys are like, we're all in tune somehow with those tuning forks.
So, in your book,
fantastic book that Pip wrote. That one, yes, thank you. You've got a character who is quite, who, there's a wonderful bit in there where you talk about how when Catherine, who's the main character, who's an engineer, she doesn't see buildings in relation to the people who are in them, she sees the buildings. And so it's like the, I'm probably saying it all wrong, but it's said much more beautifully in Pip's book, but you know, and I think about that phrase quite a lot, without being able to recall it, now I want to. But, you know, and I wonder whether or not when you're, you know, and so, you know, lots of, every chapter talks about a different, at least one different building, and that really is like a character in there, but I wonder whether or not those buildings to you are place and landscape, you know, when you wrote that, or whether or not they are, and because the character, you know, Catherine's very uncomfortable being close to what we might call the natural world, you know, and so I wonder whether or not to you the buildings were the landscape, or whether or not they were in opposition to the landscape, or if you had anything you wanted to say about that, go with it.
Yeah, well, I got in heaps of trouble because in an interview I said that I hated nature. Like and what that stems from is the fact that we were not a family that was in nature. I lived in a very urban setting. We lived around factories, and we never, the beach was like, you know, like you know, you'll get something if you walk on the sand, you know. And I've never felt relaxed in nature. Do you know what I mean? I'm getting better now, but I mean, I was always like, there will be spiders, or, you know, and we've got nothing here. There's no bears, there's nothing. And I think that's the thing, is that where I felt awe, you know, and then I got in love with the romantics, and I was like, oh, I must be like that. I must go to the mountains. And I would go to the mountains and I'd be like, oh, yuck. You know, there's no bathrooms here. So I think for me, what happened was the buildings were the things that I felt awe, you know, that stuff that I was supposed to respond, you know, like when I see the Sky Tower in Auckland, not that it's that tall, but you know, like there's a beautiful building up in Auckland, which is the new business school up there. And you know, when my friend sent me some photos of the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, and those were the places, that's kind of my nature. So I think that was what happened for me. Like, I'm honestly getting better. I'm trying harder. I went for a swim in a lake a couple of weeks ago, and I was terrified. I don't know, one of them water things. I just thought an eel. I have this idea that an eel's like that and it will eat my head, but I don't think they get that big. But, I think that's what was going on there, yeah. Do you live quite urban, or do you get to get out in nature?
Both.
Yeah. Oh, cool, yeah.
It's like a small town, so it's not cool enough to be a city, but you're not really in the woods.
Yeah.
It's just lame.
That was a bit like Auckland.
Yeah.
Auckland. Glen Innes, to be precise. You know, it was like New York.
And when you say landscape, do you mean the natural landscape, or do you mean the cities?
I think it's whatever you're surrounded by. Mm. Because, I mean, a lot of folks grow up in,
yeah,
and it's all concrete, strip malls, video games, and that's it.
Yeah.
So you can't help but be affected by that, I would imagine. Mm.
Yeah.
And then you have your internal landscapes,
yeah,
too. Who are you as a person?
I think we're going to wrap it up there. But we can stay for a bit longer, and like people can talk and stuff. So it's really cool. Oh, we have to ask Janet. Is that all right if we hang out for 10 minutes or so and hang and look at the beautiful art? So yeah, I'd just really like to thank Kirsten and Janet and Miguel, who did the food, and Jordan, of course. Thank you so much. And thanks everyone for your conversation. It was really interesting. And thank you very much.
Thanks.